This is Subversive, a podcast hosted by me, Alex Kashuta, to highlight hidden voices, uncommon perspectives, and our era's true intellectual elite, the anonymous poster. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so on Substack, Patreon, or PayPal. Thank you and enjoy. Today, I am joined by J.D. Haltigen?
Yeah, that's right. Perfect.
Haltigen. He is a student of developmental and evolutionary psychology, psychopathology, and he specializes in early experience and life history, and I think a PhD student at the University of Miami. Is that correct?
That's right. That's where I did my PhD. Yep, exactly.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on, J.D., and welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. I've enjoyed your work thus far, and your guests have been fantastic. So it's really my pleasure to be on with you.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad we can make this work. I know you're in a spicy time zone, and I'm kind of pushing my luck here with the length of your day. But I wanted to talk to you about your kind of core area of specialty, because I feel like it's very much in the news, and it's very much kind of in the field of consciousness for a lot of people. On the left, obviously, but also on the right, you know, how should we think about childhood from a psychological lens? Because like I was mentioning in the preamble to this, you know, a lot of people on the right as well, they kind of are familiar relatively with some of the literature on nature versus nurture. They tend to be more inclined to give nature its due, but at the same time, you know, I'm also kind of in the crunchy mom circles on the right, and there's quite a lot of debate about how important nurture is, and nurture seems to be very important in those circles as well. So I feel like there's a bit of a discrepancy there, and I don't think a lot of people know how to have a balanced perspective on this. For me, it seems like a lot of people think it's 100% nature, but also 100% nurture. So you just have to go hard on both and, you know, cover all your bases to make sure everything's okay. So I wonder how you've, after your studies, how you've come to look at this balance between nature and nurture.
Well, yeah, it's a really great question. You know, I when I went to do my PhD, I was very interested in attachment theory, and that's what I basically trained in. And I, you know, I completed a number of sort of internal trainings and methodological, you know, protocols that I had to go through to train and code attachment behaviors in infants and adults. And then as my sort of academic trajectory matured and I kind of went beyond, you know, I finished my PhD, I did a few postdocs, and I started kind of collaborating and engaging with more evolutionary-minded psychologists, including like Jay Belsky and others, Marco Delgaduzzi, some other colleagues that I've published with, and I kind of got into more of the, you know, nature aspect of things. So I moved away a little bit from the sort of core attachment, you know, parenting framework. But the reconciliation is really, it took place, I would say, you know, I did a postdoc at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign here in the States. And the questions that we asked there with attachment data were, you know, how much does early parenting matter, and how much does it matter when you control for, you know, longevity and duration of time? And also concurrent parenting. So, you know, if you really want to understand, does early parenting matter, you have to consider what is the child or young adult receiving in the moment. So you have to kind of parcel that out to see exactly how much, you know, the early, you know, infancy, you know, young childhood parenting actually matters statistically. And so kind of the work that we did there was sort of more methodologically sophisticated. And we looked at some, you know, structural equation models and stuff. And what we found is that, you know, to sum it up, is that, you know, early experiences as measured by observed parental sensitivity. So like, you know, we would kind of look at recordings of infants and parents in a free play. And, you know, we have coding protocols for how sensitive and responsive the parent is to the child's or the infant's signals and so forth. And what we found was that, you know, it didn't matter for later outcomes like behavior problems and academic competence and stuff like that. It didn't matter a whole, you know, statistically a lot, but it did matter significantly. So in other words, it was a smaller, but yet still important, you know, factor to account for when you were thinking about outcomes. And you know, outcomes that we typically think of are, you know, how well is the child doing in terms of emotional regulation or the, you know, the preschooler, the toddler, are they able to sort of socially engage with peers? And then as you move on up through high school, you know, what are interpersonal relations like and what are behavioral outcomes like? And so long story short, and for this study, the one that I did, the methodology has been replicated on different outcomes and with different data sets. And the bottom line is that, you know, it's a small, statistically, you know, in magnitude, it's a small, like a correlation of maybe say between 0.10 and 0.15, but it's a positive association between early parenting and later outcomes. So I guess the real take-home message to parents is that it's not that it doesn't matter. It's just that how much does it matter? And so, you know, that's going to vary, of course, from person to person. But in the aggregate, it's more of a small yet meaningful effect, if that makes sense.
And I guess in these tests, were there measures to kind of rule out any sort of genetic confounding? I know this is very hard with any sort of social science data, because I guess these were obviously directly related parents to the children, and you know, they were acting in a parental way towards the children. And I guess the second question, maybe related to this, is also the types. Obviously, you have a spectrum of types of behavior that you can apply to a child when, you know, on the one hand, you would have like intense spanking and violence and, you know, an unstable environment. On the other hand, you'd have like, you know, the most, you know, careful, you know, co-sleeping type attachment parenting style that you could imagine as well. So I wonder what kind of where on the spectrum you did these tests, and if is there kind of a big difference there, or is in general the impact of early parenting correlated to later outcomes somewhere around
0.10. So to answer your first question about the genetics aspect, the work that I did wasn't genetically informed, but the colleagues that I have had have done behavior genetic work along the same lines that's kind of basically resulted in the same message. And that is that it's sort of, you know, even when you control for genetic confounding, there is still a small but significant effect of parenting. So That work has been done. It hasn't been done maybe as extensively as in other fields, but it's there. So that issue, at least in terms of developmental psychologists, has been you know, addressed at least to some degree. I should point out at this point too that when people think of attachment and early parenting, they think of, like, let's say maybe some of these self-report questionnaires that are bandied about. And there's two things to keep in mind, really one main thing, and that is there's two real traditions of attachment research, and they're very distinct. One is the one that I was trained in, which is developmental. And they use a specific set of measures in infancy with strange situations where, you know, mom and baby come into a lab, they go through some separations and reunions, and you kind of code that. And then in adulthood, you have what's called the adult attachment interview, which is a pretty laborious interview that is recorded, it gets transcribed and coded, very detailed coding by, you know, trained coders. The other tradition is called the social personality tradition. And that's the one I think that more the lay people are familiar with. So you get asked about questions about your romantic relationships and, you know, you self-report how, you know, how acclimated you are to sort of getting close with your partner, or, you know, if you don't like getting away from them. You know, you're more connected. And so the social personality tradition is a self-report tradition. And so they stem from the same theory, John Bowlby's attachment theory. So they stem from the same conceptual framework, but they're very different methodologically. And they have their pros and cons. So, you know, that's one thing to keep in mind. I'm partial to the developmental tradition and the measures that I was trained on, obviously, because that's what I was trained in. And especially in infancy, direct observation of parents in their infants is, you know, that's really kind of the hallmark of ethology. When you think about studying animals in the wild and you think about observing, you know, for example, how monkeys interact with their parents and so forth. In terms of parenting in the developmental tradition, what we typically do is we measure, you know, we come in, we look at free plays, how do parents interact with their children in free play? So we're not exactly, you know, in the home and sort of looking at co-parenting per se, or whether or not the parent sleeps with the infant. Some of the work that's done that is more, it's not as rigorous as say your traditional developmental work. So what the basic sort of, I guess, broad ways to look at it is you want a parenting strategy that's sort of mid-range between letting the child explore their surroundings versus, you know, providing for them a safe haven in times of, you know, when they're upset. So sort of that exploration security balance or exploration attachment balance. So, you know, when we code free plays or interactions with parents and their infants, you know, too much stimulation is like intrusive. And if you have a parent who really just is totally not responsive to the child, that's sort of like avoiding, right? Like that's just no input. So those would be the two extremes. And within the sort of those two boundaries, you have a lot of variation. But those are really the two ways to look at it, sort of overstimulation versus understimulation, and sort of how does that map on to later child development or, you know, adolescent development. And the obvious answer is, you know, generally speaking, you want to have a mid-range, right? So you want to have sort of a moderate degree of scaffolding for the child where you instruct them and sort of provide them with guidance. But on the other hand, you don't want to suffocate their own novel exploration of the environment. So when you get into more like co-parenting or sleeping or helicopter parenting is another sort of kind of novel term of too much, right? So helicopter parenting would be like over-intrusive. And that's not ideal for child or youth outcomes, if that makes some sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I guess, you know, this is all kind of separate from traumatic.
Right. So, so like you would have then, you know, another sort of rung or another sort of domain would be extreme negative parenting, where you have like abuse and what we call, you know, extreme atypical parenting, such that it's just really, really at the edge of frank abuse. And I've done some work with a couple of different measures that deal with that. And so those are just basically extensions of the normal coding protocol. So, you know, instead of just coding for how responsive the parent may be to the infant signals, you're coding for things like, you know, frank, you know, physical striking or, you know, edge stuff that's sort of like right underneath CPS casework, but yet is so extreme in terms of its disoriented parenting. That it's really negative. And what you obviously see in those cases too is the more extreme the negative parenting is, the more negative relationship it has with any type of positive outcome. You know, so we you know, in infancy, we can code things like extremely inverted role reversal where the parent is just vocalizing, you know, give mommy a kiss or give daddy a kiss, so that they're inverting the relationship really clearly between the parent and the child. So the child is sort of becoming the parent. Or, you know, they're totally, you know, in some cases you have very depressed mothers where they're just emotionless. And so there's nothing really to code and there's just no input at all. And you, when you watch those, it's pretty clear that it's extremely negative parenting. Yeah.
Yeah, that's I could imagine that in a lab setting, people would refrain from acting very naturally, I guess.
There is a cap on that. So there is sort of that artifact. But even still, once you get into a free play, especially in the developmental tradition where you bring them in, you acclimate them to a room and you have toys, you know, there is it does provide sort of a somewhat ecologically valid sample of what you might see, you know, in the home. Now, when Mary Ainsworth, who was a pioneer along with John Bowlby, who did, you know, early attachment work and who developed the strange situation, and for some of your more advanced listeners, they'll know who these names are, but she created the strange situation, and her original work was in the home in Baltimore. She had, you know, RAs go in and actually code what the parent was doing in the home after a period of time where the RA was sort of, again, acclimated. So that was actually the basis on which the strange situation is developed. And most of these observational free plays, at least in infancy, are kind of predicated on that smallish Baltimore sample. And that's a limitation, of course, because it was a small sample. But one of the measures that has really, you know, hung together well over the course of time and is really valid is the strange situation in infancy for infant attachment. So, you know, that's another reason why I'm partial to the developmental tradition, because the work that's been done research-wise, I think, is a little bit stronger than what's maybe happened in social personality, even though that's still reasonable as well.
Yeah, I think that what you hear called a social personality tradition, that is... very much the core of a lot of kind of the crunchy mom tradition. And there's a lot of right. You know, essentially, yeah, attachment parenting is associated very much with the sleep and not sleep training, sleep training versus not sleep training mm-hmm. thing, which is a big war mm-hmm. in the mommy circles. Apparently, obviously, if you're very much into the attachment direction, then the idea is that, you know, if you have an infant or a toddler, they are with you nonstop. You do contact naps. You don't separate at all. So that's
right. And that's kind of one of the things that's actually been written about in the developmental tradition of attachment research, is trying to get the message out that mentality is distinct and kind of inconsistent with what's actually the really, you know, strong developmental research, which is based in the strange situation. So that sort of crunchy mommy stuff with co-parenting and never having the child leave your side is not really attachment, right? It's not predicated on any body of work that's really rigorous. So even in developmental circles of attachment, within academia, there's been papers that have really tried to distinguish the sort of misconceptions amongst the lay people that kind of stuff is more, I guess you could say, pop attachment than it is really the good attachment research that's been, you know, done in the developmental tradition over time and using statistical methods and you know, actually doing good research. And that's kind of too bad too, because, you know, parents see that's kind of popular media stuff, and they're misled as to, number one, really what is attachment theory? And number two, inherent to attachment theory is the core concept of secure exploration. So in other words, you know, you have that exploration security balance. You don't want to overstimulate, but you want the child to explore, to engage in some novel exploration of their environment, to develop competency and cognition and competency with mastery of the environment. But on the other hand, when the infant, for example, or the child experiences unsettlement or something that challenges the attachment system so that they're upset, you want to have that ability for the child to feel safe to, you know, quickly return and expect that the parent will be there. So, you know, I've been trying to kind of battle that a little bit in terms of when I tweet or when I speak out on Twitter, I try to speak out about the work that I've published and kind of correct the record. But as I've moved into more, you know, evolutionary psychopathology, it's almost become a different game of trying to rein in those on the right who think that parenting is everything. And so it is, like you pointed out at the top of the show, it is a unique balancing act, especially on the right, because they do value the family. And of course, the family is important. But on the other hand, there is a level of determinism there that is genetic and temperamental that, you know, it's going to express itself regardless of the parenting that the child gets.
That seems to be one of the courses I see as well with kind of new fertility tech as well. I mean, obviously, I have all sorts of objections against surrogacy, you know, partly religious, partly just in terms of kind of virtue ethics. I mean, I don't necessarily think like the complete commercialization of producing young is a good idea just for a species in general. But a lot of the kind of pushback against surrogacy is also tied to kind of this idea that, you know, the child is going to be separated from the mother, and then that adverse childhood experience will mark the child will scar them for life, and it's going to be it's an kind of unfair and profoundly detrimental way to treat a child, which I think, you know, obviously sounds intuitively very correct to me as a mother, knowing that I would very much not like to have anyone. I literally have, like yesterday night, I had a nightmare about someone at the hospital, you know, stealing my new baby. So this is very instinctively implanted that this is a possibility and you don't want it to happen. But at the same time, I know that the research is not necessarily, you know, very clear about what happens, you know, when, you know, in case of adoption, things like that. So I wonder what your position is on surrogacy and kind of how you see that from a kind of a child development perspective.
I kind of tend to agree with you. I mean, I think that the child parent relationship, in particular, the mother child relationship, is extremely important. And that's been informed by most of my reading. And I mean, I've delved very deeply into, even beyond, you know, prior to Bowlby, one of my big idols was Donald Woodward Winnicott, who was a British psychoanalyst who was kind of on the same page with Bowlby, a little bit more kind of, you know, woo-woo psychoanalytic. But at the same time, his rich clinical description, you know, even if it wasn't research, really drilled down on the importance of that early maternal child relationship. So, you know, he talked about maternal preoccupation, and when you were just mentioning you had the nightmare there, I was like, think that's a natural, completely natural motherly instinct. You know, women have unique biologies that are oriented towards a caregiving system. I mean, it makes complete evolutionary sense, and to deny that or to, you know, to somehow suggest that that's abnormal is ridiculous. So it's a very unique situation. Now, obviously, in certain cases, you know, surrogacy is perhaps warranted where the parent is incapacitated or there's just some egregious break. But in general, you want that you know, mother-infant bond, or in the case of, you know, a father-infant bond as well, you want that to be solidified. You want that to be nurtured. And so separation, long-term separation, which even Bowlby showed, you know, his early work with James Robertson showed that, you know, if the child is separated from their parent for long periods of time, there is some negative outcome in terms of avoidance, and, you know, it would take a while to reestablish that sort of bond. So, you know, even though I'm not a parent and I haven't really had to really think hard about those issues, you know, I lean more to the conservative side of that in terms of my understanding, not just of the role of early experience, but once you really drill down on evolution and the evolutionary importance of why, you know, mothers are oriented towards responding that way across, it's universal too. I mean, it's stylistically different maybe across races and across cultures, but it's a universal phenomenon, attachment and to feel caregiving, you know. So in that sense, I think, you know, surrogacy. I mean, I don't want to say to avoid it, but yet at the same time, it's not optimal. It's probably the best way to put it, if you will.
Yes, I think that's probably the case with a lot of fertility tech and things that are kind of coming up on the horizon. And I know a lot of people kind of see them as optimal. The idea that you can do embryo selection and all these types of things. I mean, I'm still a bit of a skeptic.
Yeah, and that's I think a lot of people will look at that from a purely sort of statistical, mechanical way and say, yeah, you can select for all the best things, or you can do this and do that, but you know, part of what Winnicott emphasized in his rich clinical description is the creativity of culture and the creativity of life and sort of engaging that. And once you sort of sanitize all that away, what are you left with, right? Like you're almost becoming, you know, the stereotypical autistic sort of way of thinking in terms of, you know, completely emotionless, or you know, not having that sort of that sort of give and take and creativity to be spontaneous and emotional and so forth. So, you know, that's partly what spurred a lot of the work on autism, right? Is that people noticed that the deficits in emotion and responsivity were in the child were problematic and concerning. And of course, now with the sort of more neurodiversity approach, we have, you know, I mean, I think it's a good thing to understand that everybody who's disordered, you know, is treated appropriately and not to a certain degree stigmatized. But yeah, at the same time, and I've written about this too, is that, you know, you can't destigmatize these conditions. You can't talk about them as if they're normal. They're not. And so, you know, it's important to have that sort of creativity. And once you get into all this new sort of new age technology of embryo selection and, you know, extreme calibration of development, it can get a little weird. Certainly in the case of, you know, genetic abnormality where, you know, you can perhaps avoid something that's very severely incapacitating, then maybe. But even then, you get into very controversial ethical issues. So,
yes, I think you bring up a really interesting question about autism, and it has seemed to have kind of an explosion in terms of at least the way it's diagnosed. I wonder, do you believe that there is kind of an underlying issue in that the prevalence of autism has grown? Or is it a case of overdiagnosis, or is it both? I mean, this is not the only kind of childhood type developmental or kind of mental disorder that's being overdiagnosed or increasingly diagnosed now. I mean, you have ADHD. I mean, you even have multiple personality disorder, though that's probably from TikTok. But yeah, there's just all sorts of kind of things that were clearly psychopathology back in the day that now just kind of turned into identity.
Yeah, no, and that's one of the things that I've written extensively about. I'm not a clinician, but I'm, you know, obviously my work is extremely adjacent to clinical work, and I do a lot of, you know, methodological work around understanding how the symptoms and expressions of these disorders hang together statistically and how do they express themselves phenotypically. And so I think in the case of, you know, autism, it's a little bit of both. You know, again, with autism, you have clinicians who will just diagnose based on DSM criteria, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. But then in the research tradition, you have what's called the ADOS and the ADI, which are the Autism Diagnostic Observational Schedule, the Autism, you know, Diagnostic Interview, which are much more, you know, intensive and so forth. So, you know, again, you have sort of that split between what common lay people think is autism, and then when you bring them into the lab, where do they make cutoff criteria on, say, the ADOS or the ADI for a diagnosis? So it gets a little bit mixed and sort of mangled together. And I think there has been overdiagnoses, but I think with social media, and this is just me off the cuff, I think there probably is a slight uptick in the prevalence, maybe, and you know, with what you're seeing in terms of, young people on social media. It can amplify some of the symptomatology of autism. I think, you know, just repetitive, complete immersion into sort of a social world where there's no contact with sort of human interaction in vivo or in situ, like where you're actually interacting with other people in your environment versus being in the cloud. So it's, you know, I had no real clear cut definitive answers, or, you know, I can't speak to any work that I've done on that specifically, but I think there has been a little bit of both. And then in the case of the other common clinical disorders like ADHD, depression, there's no doubt they're being consumerized as identities now. That has seeped into the gender identity insanity. I've written a little bit about that, about how social media is contributing to that. And so there, in those cases, and sort of the more common clinical disorders, it's definitely been an overdiagnosis, and in many cases, self-diagnosis. So, you know, what reliable numbers do we have that are based on actual, you know, clinician diagnoses?
That's it is interesting, because I feel like I'm probably one of the people in this subgroup, especially because once COVID started, we kind of entered this, you know, purely digital realm, and I spent a lot of time working. I was working kind of in finance back then, like literally maybe 13, 14, 15 hours a day on screens. Mm-hmm. And after a few months, I just got the problem that I literally could not focus on anything. I couldn't do my work. I couldn't even, you know, relax. I couldn't do anything. It was just kind of hooked into whatever loop that the screen was on at that point. And I got convinced that I had ADHD, and like kind of sudden onset ADHD, because I fit all of the diagnostic criteria except for the historical criteria, which I kind of overlooked when I had to complete all the diagnosis, because it was like, oh, did you have trouble with in school? I was like, sometimes I did. I probably didn't really. I was a pretty good student. You know, you could also kind of fabricate those memories if it's convenient. But I was completely convinced that I had like pure hardcore ADHD, even sought out the diagnosis, obviously, and, you know, got a prescription for Concerta, which is Ritalin. This is kind of the thing that you get in Europe. It wasn't good. I was just strung out for about a month on Ritalin, because I was just, you know, this is the thing that's supposed to help me. But actually it was just a weird temporary addiction thing that I didn't know how to handle. And it was, you know, but the diagnostic criteria fit to a T, and almost in an extreme. Like I said, except for the, you know, the fact that it was an onset in whatever adolescence or in my youth, but just happened to start at the, whatever, 32, or when the COVID thing hit. So it was a strange thing. I can definitely see how people would convince themselves of this, because the information about this stuff is ubiquitous.
Yeah. And I mean, I think with one of the things that I've been kind of putting together some conceptual thoughts in my head, it's really, and I published a piece on this with social media, but it's immersive. So it's immersive social media. So, you know, one of the things that we noticed in early infant research with autism is sort of this concept of sticky attention, right? The infant or the child can't disengage from a stimulus. So think of the prototypical case of spinning the wheel on a car and the autistic child, and they just can't stop spinning it. But once you get into that realm that you were just talking about there, and I've experienced this myself too with social media, the Twitter feed, it's just, it rains down, and you just focus and dial in on it. And before long, your attention is sticky. You can't pull away. And so it becomes almost sort of like this autistic world that you're in, engaging online or with numbers. Or in the case, you know, I think that's one major thing. And during COVID, we saw the uptick with especially young adolescent females with the TikTok tics. And so if you're just engaging with consistent, sticky attention on some sort of social media, immersive, audiovisually immersive feed, it can become heavily sort of phenotypically like an autistic setting very quickly. And so I've even caught that in myself, and I still do. I do a lot of work with data, as you know, like you, I work with numbers, I work with statistics. I think Twitter is addicting in a way, because not because I want to, you know, shit talk or shit post, but there is a high degree of high quality information that comes through on Twitter. And if you're programmed to sort of want to distill that, it can become heavily addictive. And even when you're just reading other people's tweets, whether it's politically or whether it's academic Twitter, you're pulling information like words and numbers, and so you're learning in a way like, how are people expressing themselves, and you're integrating that into sort of your own arsenal of knowledge. So it can become for the sort of vulnerable mind, if you're sort of more obsessive in nature. And I mean, I know for myself, like I'm much more, you know, if you want to look at autism as a spectrum, I'm definitely up there, right? I'm more aloof. It's 2:14 here in the morning. I'm looking at the Twitter screen, talking with you. The difference in, like you said, you didn't meet that one criteria for ADHD. With me, like, you know, I played sports and all throughout, up through college, right? So I had sort of, if I didn't have that experience of engaging with sort of just regular stupid world kind of locker room banality, I might be like really extremely even more autistic in nature, you know. And I can talk freely about that. I have no, you know, I saw a recent couple of series of political stuff here in the States where people were criticizing Ron DeSantis for being a little bit like more autistic or unreachable to the sort of like, you know, versus Trump, right? And I'm like, that's what makes DeSantis so good, is that sort of trait systemization, which is an autistic sort of trait of focusing in and you know, understanding systems and rules. And that's what makes him so great in a situation like where he's got to repair bridges after a hurricane. So yeah, I mean, it's a wild world, but the more that we move to a society that's completely screen based, if the person who's, you know, who has to engage on screens is not able to modulate their own screen time, it can become very toxic very quick. And so for me, like, one of the strategies has been, okay, up and down. Like, you know, I'll spend an hour, 2 hours max at the computer screen. And then I'm like out in the garage working on my model railroad or jumping rope or, you know, doing something physical. And that's one difference I've noticed between before and versus after the pandemic. When I was in grad school, Twitter wasn't around, but Facebook was. But Facebook is not really immersive, right? You're not seeing a feed. And I would sit at my graduate school office desk all day long. And I would sort of, you know, I sit there for 3-4 hours and then I might go to the gym for 2. Now it's much more different, right? Like, I'm looking at the Twitter feed for an hour, boom, I'm up and moving around. So like the world is just completely different. And I think if you don't have that ability at some level, let's say you're an adolescent female during the pandemic, right? You're on your phone sitting in a chair all day long. And, you know, that sticky attention again, I mean, again, that can lead to a lot of mental health issues. And I think conceptually, this is how I'm starting to see why smartphones and why social media, immersive social media, is so devastating, I think, for mental health.
Yes, I think what you highlight there, the kind of that seeking instinct, and yeah, I'm definitely one of the more aloof people myself. It really reminds me, like, the same state I'm in when I'm scrolling through Twitter, which is obviously my platform of choice. I have the same kind of intense focus that I have when I'm foraging, which is one of my favorite hobbies, to just, mm-hmm. you know, go out, very Eastern European things to go out, collect mushrooms or whatever,
hoarding,
chestnuts
hoarding,
and stuff.
Hoarding, yeah, collection. And exactly. You're systemizing.
Yeah, it's very, very strange, but it's like I'm almost comically focused when I'm out foraging.
And if you think about the comorbidity of disorders, OCD, ADHD, and autism all have high comorbidity, and that you're expressing the same trait. I have the same issue. Like you said, you go out and collect nuts, and you're doing that exactly what Baron Code would talk about, is this trait systemization. You're ordering the world. You're collecting apricots and you're sorting them here, and you're collecting maybe chestnuts and you're sorting them here. For me, I go out into the back of my garage and I'm like, I have a massive collection of hockey gloves, right? It's this one particular type of glove that I saw on a player when I was a young kid, and I perseverate on it, and I've sought out and collected. You know, it's a glove that's no longer made, but I must have found now through like just laborious internet searches and Kijiji and eBay, like 5 or 6 pairs of the original used pairs. And like, I sort them and I clean them and I order them. It's all that same autistic trait systemization, but there's trade-offs, right? Like, so you can, if you perseverate too long on that, then you become, you know, once you take that to the extreme of the autistic child, then you become really sort of impaired. Or in the case of where it overlaps with other mental health issues, in the case of adolescent females, and you're doing stereotypies and tics, you're impaired, even if it's not real tics in the sense of neurologically embedded, but it's that same trait. And we all fall on that spectrum. But my concern for young people is that you're able to recognize that and see that, right? You're able to say, I see this hoarding, and you can understand how that fits into the overall underlying genetic basis of all this. And I think I can too. Doesn't necessarily mean, you know, I'm going to be okay, but at least I can sort of understand who I am. I don't think that the young people developing nowadays, you know, they're not there. And so they're just sucked into these immersive social media platforms. And, you know, if the parenting is not there, we talked about parenting, you know, earlier, it can become a toxic stew for mental health issues.
Yeah. I think it's so important to kind of know yourself, and, you know, kind of have parameters around what you can do well, what you can't do. And I think maybe a lot of the striving to kind of create identities around mental health disorders is—it's
a lack of
in identity. A positive way,
right?
Yeah, lack of it, but people are trying to know themselves, trying to kind of, you know, figure out something, some skeleton key that will unlock, you know, a good experience of life and kind of free them from their limitations, or at least get them to kind of accept them and say, you know, I think that's kind of the good, you know, intention behind a lot of this. But obviously it goes off the rails quite
quickly. Right. And when it gets off the rails or hijacked by ideologies, what happens is two things. One is that the individual who is building their identity around, let's say, you know, for me and you, if we were in that mindset, we'd be like, oh, we have OCD or we have ADHD or we have autism, but we know we don't, right? Like we're on that sort of, we see things not as binaries or categories. And in the case of mental health disorders, most of them, at least in terms of statistically, they're not, they're all on spectrums. We all have a little bit or a lot. And once you get to a certain threshold, that then there's sort of clinical intervention is necessary. But with consumer identities now is that two things happen. One is that the individual who's constructing their identity around that diagnosis is not really understanding who they are, like you and I might. And number two is that once that becomes consumerized and becomes hijacked by ideologies, the people that truly are suffering from real disorder are you're sort of almost in a way marginalizing them, because the disorder becomes a caricature of itself. And so, you know, there's people with real depression, and then there's people who are maybe sad or upset, but they claim that they're like majorly depressed, right? And they're just, you know, so that's part of the issue. But when you build identities around mental health diagnoses in a way that's so, I guess, making them a caricature of what we traditionally have thought of classically as mental health disorder, it becomes really dangerous.
You've mentioned that you've done some work on kind of this concept of destigmatizing, and you thought about it. And I always wonder, you know, if there is a possibility to destigmatize something without normalizing it, because it doesn't seem to me that that's a category out in the wild. It's like once you destigmatize something, you're essentially normalizing it, and you're trying to tell people that it's okay, and you know, it's just a you know another feather in your cap to have whatever multiple personality disorder.
Yeah, and I think that's a real issue. I think a lot of academics now have become totally ideologically captured, and the destigmatization is around, well, you know, there were some abuses that happened in psychiatric hospitals back in the day. And so, you know, obviously you don't want people who have mental health issues being totally treated inhumanely by society, right? Like, but on the other hand, that they're ill. Right, they're deviant. They're statistically different from the norm. And once you normalize that, then a society can't function. And so the problem is getting them. You know, there's a difference between saying we need to treat sick people humanely versus sick people aren't really sick. No, they are. They are, and it's okay to say that. And it's okay to say that in a way that might be insensitive at times, but if you want a society that functions and has appropriate taboos and that allows for humane functioning at scale, then you have to have stigma. And there's healthy, adaptive cultural stigma. I have a piece that's coming out soon in Aporia that deals with this. And it's gotten to the point now where, like, for example, in academia, it's so ridiculous that they're like, you know, courses like abnormal psychology, you can't. They don't want to call it abnormal psychology anymore. And like, I mean, to me, that's just bonkers. You know, I could see maybe developmental psychopathology, or even if you want to say, okay, we don't want to label a course abnormal because the term abnormal is sort of somehow insensitive and you want to call it psychopathology. There's even academics who think that psychopathology is too much and they want to call it problems in living. And that becomes counterproductive and just utterly insane. And so I really am reactive to some of that sort of mindset in academia, because it's unhelpful. And it's unhelpful not only to the person who's suffering because they're not getting the appropriate care and the appropriate message, but it's also unhelpful to the culture at large, because the more you try to normalize what's not normal, the common person, the common population is going to reject that. And we're seeing that now. I mean, just tonight here in the States, we had, you know, in California, this big, huge parents, some Armenian parents were just reacting intensively to this gender stuff going on in the schools. And so that's just a manifestation of that type of thing. You cannot normalize what is statistically abnormal. And if you try to do that at a societal level scale, you know, you're going to have things like we're seeing now spill out here in the States, and it's becoming untenable, especially with the gender stuff.
Yeah, it does seem to me that what you see in psychology and pretty much across the board now in our culture, our global culture, is that you move the locus of focus from the societal level to the individual.
It's and totally
the societal, that. Yeah, the societal level is seen as oppressive by default. And then what you can do is address these problems in living to the individual, and then you treat them at the individual level, let the chips fall where they may for whatever the societal level, because, you know, it's not only not okay to, you know, it's good to ignore the societal level, because, you know, that's where all the problems come from. That's where all the oppression comes from.
Mm-hmm. It's totally a levels problem. And I've gone back, there's a few papers conceptually in the psychopathology world that deals specifically with this levels problem. And so you have, you know, what we call a cluster model in academia, where you look at schools, and you have individuals nested within schools, and you have schools, then you have classrooms, and you have individuals. And what's happened now is you see a total, complete, the sort of everything has to be my truth or individual level, you know, single person analysis. And what matters for stable functioning of societies is the population, is the higher level structure, where you're organizing social policy around statistical norms. And what's happened now is with the, you know, I don't politically, I mean, I've looked into some ideologies, but like with hardcore left-wing radical progressivism and sort of this more neo-Marxist stuff, it's totally that the individual has to be liberated from all constraints. And it's sort of this like individual my truth analysis. And that is completely untenable for stable societal functioning. And so a lot of what you're seeing here in the States now is pushback to that just insanity. People are starting to recognize exactly what this is. And that is, it's just a levels issue. And the left, particularly the radical left, will say that, well, society imprisons them and oppresses them. And no, it just constrains them. You can't have total liberation from, you know, you can't have mentally ill people in positions of political power. You can't have people who are, not capable of flying airplanes. It just does not work. That's not oppression. That's just structuring a society that allows it to function humanely for everybody. And so we've seen this just really perverted, and I've called it a pathocracy. I've read some work of Andrew Labosweski, and I'm writing a Substack on his book Political Pornology, which really I think gets at this. It's just a complete perversion of what's needed at the societal level versus what the non-normal, you're trying to center social policy based on groups who are statistically abnormal. It's just no other way to say it.
Yeah. I mean, if your perspective on life is that every pathology, every issue in society is downstream from oppression,
right,
it does make sense. Obviously, this is absolutely not borne out by any data in any,
it's not. And that's not to deny that oppression has occurred. It's not to deny that there's been cases of, every person that you've had on your show has mentioned this, like Heather McDonald is very clear cut about the past injustices of, America and the slave trade. And it's not ignoring that, but to understand this, you have to have an appreciation of biology. And so, you know, once you understand that human people are not created equally, there's this human variation, and we have to account for that in social policy in the most humane way possible. You know, you can't let petty tyrants who are mentally ill dictate what's going to happen. I'm putting it crudely, of course, but that's basically what's happening now with some of the more crazy stuff that we're seeing. It's downstream of academia, which is part of the problem, is that, academics, the ivory tower is called the ivory tower for a reason. They kind of, they're able to shield themselves from the real world, the sort of, and so a lot of these ideas, these crazy ideas of, gender identity, gender ideology, even stuff like restorative justice, where you don't punish people for their crimes because that's somehow seen as mean, even if it's disproportionately that Black adolescents, for example, are put in juvenile residential facilities for crimes, it's automatically seen as, well, that's prejudice or racist or evidence of racism. Well, no, they might disproportionately engage in criminal behavior or aggressive behavior more frequently, which then leads them to encounter the police more frequently, which certainly could lead to more potential cases of injustice. But on the other hand, it's going to lead to their disparity and going into the residential facility. And so, you have to understand all these factors, and that might mean that we have to stress cultural factors in parenting and how do we rehabilitate or how do we discipline certain groups. So I think those are all questions that cannot be off limits in a society that's healthy. You have to be able to talk about that openly.
And again, I mean, you know, the idea that you focus your efforts of rehabilitation on the individual and not on the completely insane fallout that, you know, recidivism and just crime itself has, not only on society at large, but particularly on the communities that these people come from, which are apparently, you know, protected classes, is insane. But, you know,
I mean, and Steve Saylor has talked about this frequently. Chicago is a good example. Even here where I'm from, which is in Pittsburgh, you're seeing this push for restorative justice, and there's crime that's in the downtown. And Pittsburgh's a fairly middle-sized American city that's, you know, seeing the progressive policies just destroying, you know, it's degrading the livable conditions in the downtown area for those reasons, because there's no accountability. And it is actually hurting the populations that are protected. And so, you know, if you have chaos all around your city, you can't function. I mean, San Francisco is, you know, Mike Schellenberger has talked about that a lot. It's a prototypical example. New York City's been off the rails. And so, you know, you have to have the ability to analyze data at multiple levels, ask questions that are able to be asked, and to inform policy based on asking those questions, like Heather McDonald would ask, without being attacked, without being called a racist or a sexist in the case of, you know, the gender stuff or what have you. But that has to stop. That has to stop.
Yeah. I mean, I am hopeful with the stopping. I can't put a date on it, but yeah, it will eventually have to give somewhere. I know that we are coming up on time, and I know it is literally the middle of the night there. So I will wrap up with the last question. This is the
question
that everyone gets. Do you have a recommendation for a thinker that you think is underrated, you know, potentially subversive in the spirit of the show, someone who you think could be interesting to the listeners?
That's an interesting question. I think one of the people on Twitter that I initially sort of started to focus in on was Wes Yang. A lot of his tweet threads are so very incisive and detailed, and he's really taken up the arms for, I guess, what you would call, you know, he's not an academic in the sense of, you know, the academic setting, but he's just very brilliant, and his prose is excellent. His tweet threads are very insightful. He gets the problem. Expressed at all levels of, you know, from academia on down through society. So I guess that would be one that comes to mind, you know, initially. I've had so many interactions with so many brilliant people, especially during the pandemic. You know, Twitter groups, Twitter DM groups just sort of emerged spontaneously. And I've met, you know, some that I've done research with. One of my colleagues who recently moved back to Europe, Marco Del Guidusi, who's an evolutionary psychopathologist and evolutionary psychologist, is brilliant. I mean, unreal. He's not on Twitter, but his work, research-wise, can be Googled and read. Those are two that really have impacted me, I would say. And then, of course, for those of your listeners who are parents, you know, go back to John Bowlby. Google John Bowlby, the person who really was sort of the founder of attachment theory, and get a sense of who he was and what he did. And you know, attachment is not Freud. Attachment is not psychoanalysis. It has roots there a little bit, but, you know, one of the things that people don't know about John Bowlby was that he was kicked out of the British Psychoanalytic Society because he didn't want to focus in on this sort of woo-woo sort of fantasy world of Freud. He wanted to ground it in evolutionary biology. And that really is the core appeal of attachment theory, is that it was grounded in biology. But that got lost along the way because people don't really know the deep roots of attachment theory.
Mm, yeah, no, those are all really good recommendations. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you too. I mean, we've kind of run the gamut. I hope that listeners find it, you know, insightful, and certainly we can potentially do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. Is there any place you'd like people to go to look up your work or find out?
I would just say my Twitter is really where I would direct everybody. So at JD Haltigan, JD Haltigan. So HALTIGAN, first two initials, JD. And then I have a Substack, which is linked on my Twitter feed. So the more that I feel Twitter is really a way for me to speak out right now, given the sort of oppressive climate in academia, and I'm really trying to build my platform there. And I guess in a way to not just build my platform, but learn, right? I'm a little bit more of a truculent academic type. And so a lot of things that you can't say in academia, you know, I'm able to more freely express on Twitter. I can push back against some of what I feel like is encroaching upon me in academia on Twitter. And even though I'm not in the States, I'm a registered independent. I lean, I guess, right, but I have many views that would probably be considered at least classically left in terms of views around maybe some gun legislation or abortion. But I feel like I'm just much more freer to communicate good research that I've been trained in. And I'm grateful to, you know, all of my prior training has been great. It's just a shame to see that academia has been corrupted so badly. And so, you know, I guess without going on too much longer, like I would say, direct them to my Twitter. And then from there, you know, I'm more than happy to engage and, you know, hopefully connect with other people who have similar views or who challenge me to think differently about issues.
Yeah, excellent. I mean, that's why I'm on Twitter and continue being on Twitter, even though it does take its toll. It's, you know, it wants its pound of flesh, obviously, but it's a good platform. I will link your Twitter handle in the show notes, and I want to thank you again for coming on.
Hey, listen, thank you so much, and have a great day over in Europe.
If you'd like to support my work and access more content, please consider subscribing through Substack, Patreon, or PayPal. See you next week.